Hi there, my name's Dimity, and please join with me this evening as we read from Daniel chapter 4. We're going to start at verse 10 and go through to verse 37. If you're reading from the Pew Bibles, that can be found on page 616. These are the visions I saw while lying in bed. I looked, and there before me stood a tree in the middle of the land. Its height was enormous. The tree grew large and strong, and its top touched the sky. It was visible to the ends of the earth. Its leaves were beautiful, its fruit abundant, and on it was food for all. Under it, the wild animals found shelter, and the birds lived in its branches. From it, every creature was fed. In the visions I saw while lying in bed, I looked, and there before me was a holy one, a messenger, coming down from heaven. He called in a loud voice, "Cut down the tree and trim off its branches, strip off its leaves and scatter its fruit. Let the animals flee from under it and the birds from its branches. But let the stump and its roots, bound with iron and bronze, remain in the ground, in the grass of the field. Let him be drenched with the dew of heaven, and let him live with the animals among the plants of the earth. Let his mind be changed from that of a man, and let him be given the mind of an animal, till seven times pass by for him. The decision is announced by messengers. The Holy One declares the verdict, so that the living may know that the Most High is sovereign over all kingdoms on earth and gives them to anyone he wishes and sets over them the lowliest of people. This is the dream that I, King Nebuchadnezzar, had. Now, Belteshazzar, tell me what it means, for none of the wise men in my kingdom can interpret it for me. But you can, because the spirit of the holy gods is in you. Then Daniel, also called Belteshazzar, was greatly perplexed for a time, and his thoughts terrified him, so that the king said, "Belteshazzar, do not let the dream or its meaning alarm you." Belteshazzar answered, "My lord, if only the dream applied to your enemies and its meaning to your adversaries. The tree you saw, which grew large and strong, with its top touching the sky, visible to the whole earth, with beautiful leaves and abundant fruit, providing food for all, giving shelter to the wild animals, and having nesting places in its branches for the birds. Your Majesty, you are that tree. You have become great and strong. Your greatness has grown until it reaches the sky, and your dominion extends to distant parts of the earth. Your Majesty saw a holy one, a messenger, coming down from heaven and saying, 'Cut down the tree and destroy it, but leave the stump, bound with iron and bronze, in the grass of the field, while its roots remain in the ground. Let him be drenched with the dew of heaven. Let him live with the wild animals until seven times pass by for him.' This is the interpretation, Your Majesty, and this is the decree that the Most High has issued against my lord the king. You will be driven away from people and will live with the wild animals. You will eat grass like the ox and be drenched with the dew of heaven. Seven times will pass by for you until you acknowledge that the Most High is sovereign over all the kingdoms on earth and gives them to anyone he wishes. The command to leave the stump of the tree with its roots means that your kingdom will be restored to you when you acknowledge that heaven rules. Therefore, Your Majesty, be pleased to accept my advice. Renounce your sins by doing what is right and your wickedness by being kind to the oppressed. It may be then that your prosperity will continue." All this happened to King Nebuchadnezzar. 12 months later, as the king was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon, he said, "Is not this the great Babylon I have built as the royal residence, by my mighty power and for the glory of my majesty?" Even as the words were on his lips, a voice came from heaven. "This is what is decreed for you, King Nebuchadnezzar. Your royal authority has been taken from you. You will be driven away from people and will live with the wild animals. You will eat grass like the ox. Seven times will pass by for you until you acknowledge that the Most High is sovereign over all the kingdoms on earth and gives them to anyone he wishes." Immediately what had been said about Nebuchadnezzar was fulfilled. He was driven away from the people and ate grass like the ox. His body was drenched with dew of heaven until his hair grew like feathers of an eagle and his nails like the claws of a bird. At the end of that time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven and my sanity was restored. Then I praised the Most High. I honoured and glorified him who lives forever. His dominion is an eternal dominion. His kingdom endures from generation to generation. All the peoples of the earth are regarded as nothing. He does as he pleases with the powers of the heaven, and the peoples of the earth. No one can hold back his hand or say to him, "What have you done?" At the same time that my sanity was restored, my honour and splendour were returned to me for the glory of my kingdom. My advisers and nobles sought me out, and I was restored to my throne and became even greater than before. Now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and exalt and glorify the King of heaven, because everything he does is right and all his ways are just, and those who walk in pride he is able to humble.
Hey, my name's Tom. If we haven't met before, I would love to do that after the service. We've got about 25, 30 minutes now to help us see how relevant that passage is for our lives here in 2024. To start that off, can I make the observation that what we are dealing with tonight is history? Sometimes people read the Bible, particularly the Old Testament, and they say these are stories constructed to help us learn something. And you say, well, they do help us learn something, but we are dealing with real people in real time. For example, King Nebuchadnezzar is the main guy in tonight's passage. And if you go to the British Museum, you might be able to see artifacts a little bit like this one. If you go across to Berlin, you go to the Pergamon Museum, you might be able to see the Ishtar Gate, some of which is literally like transplanted, some of it's reconstructed. It's this big blue thing. And on the inside panel, if your Akkadian's really great, you might be able to translate these kind of words about Nebuchadnezzar. It says, "Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, the pious prince appointed by the will of Marduk." I'm just trying to say that tonight we're talking about history. We're talking about real stuff, real people. He had a dream, but then it came true. And we're talking about things that have really happened in real time and space. Now, the Bible's been read for us, so you don't need an in-depth walkthrough verse by verse. Can I just give you a quick summary of the big picture of what happens, and then we're going to spend most of our time talking about why it matters for you. Here's the run-through. He's got a dream. Nebuchadnezzar, one of the most powerful men in the world at the time, has a dream of a massive tree. And underneath that tree, all of the animals find their existence. They perch in the trees. They look for shelter. But Daniel has the unenviable job of interpreting that dream for one of the most powerful military rulers in the world. And he has to say, "I wish it wasn't, but you're the tree." And there's great lengths gone to throughout the whole passage to emphasize that the tree is not entirely uprooted and chucked out, but the roots remain. And that kind of hints at the idea that as the passage goes on, there's a possibility of restoration, renewal, repentance. But all of this happens exactly the way the dream told it would. The king of Babylon, Nebuchadnezzar, is standing on his palace roof. He's looking out at everything, and he makes this proud declaration, this proud boast. And from there, almost immediately, God humbles him and turns him into some kind of a beast-like thing. But from there, after seven times, which could be 7 years, 7 months, seven seasons, we're not super sure, he raises his eyes to heaven again and he's restored. And so he's got, you know, maybe a slightly bigger palace or something like that. Now, you're supposed to save these kind of moments for the end of the sermon, but if you'll notice this V-shaped thing, that's actually very similar to the life path of Jesus, right? He starts high in the heavens. Unlike Nebuchadnezzar, he chooses to humble himself. He goes down low. He comes down to earth. He goes down even lower to the cross. He goes down from the cross into the grave. But from there, He's glorified and restored and raised back up. And now what God is doing in the world, Ephesians 1:10, is gathering a group of people together who worship that Jesus. He's raised up to, if it was possible, an even higher position. So there's kind of an analogy between Nebuchadnezzar's path and the path of Jesus. That's the overview of what happens tonight. Hopefully you're tracking with me now. And I want to spend the entire rest of our time, if it's okay with you, just talking about one point only. That point is pride. As you were studying the passage in your growth group this week, if you're not in a growth group, we'd love to help you get in one. You might have noticed the idea of power runs the whole way through this chapter. And if you're particularly keen, you might have seen verse 17, 25, and 32 say almost exactly the same thing three times about how God is even more powerful than the most powerful people you can imagine. And we could spend a whole 25, 30 minutes doing that theme, but for tonight, I thought there'd be a lot of value for us in talking about pride. That's where we're going for the next 20 minutes or so. Here's what Dorothy Sayers said about pride. This is her definition. She said, the proud person says, I am the master of my fate, captain of my soul. Notice the I, me, my stuff. I, the captain of my fate. I am the captain of my soul. In 2024 language, you might say, I will set my moral compass and nobody will tell me what to do because I am in charge of me. Dorothy Sayers was saying, yeah, that's kind of the heart of pride. It's this inward turn. What I would love for you to notice is how incredibly similar that is to what Nebuchadnezzar says. If you've got your Bibles, now's the time to look at them. Verse 29 to 30, chapter 4, verse 29 to 30, how similar it is to what Dorothy Sayers defined pride as. So 12 months later, because God gives a mercy period there between the dream and when the actual stuff goes down, as the king was walking on the roof of the royal palace of Babylon, he said, is not this the great Babylon I have built as the royal residence by my mighty power for the glory of my majesty? It's this inward turn that he's taken. And I take it that if you're like me, sometimes you're given to the same kind of inward turn. One time someone came up to Jesus and said, can I please have the cheat code on the Old Testament? There's a lot of stuff written there. What's the most important command? And Jesus says, it's kind of two. Love the Lord your God with all your heart and soul and mind and strength, and love your neighbor as yourself. In terms of the opposite of the inward turn, what's he telling people to do? He's saying that humans function at their pinnacle when they look up and when they look out. And humans are functioning as less than human when we spend our whole time looking in. The only moment that Jesus references looking in is as the yardstick for how much we're meant to look out, because he says, love your neighbor as yourself. Most people are pretty good at loving themselves. And if only we could love other people in the same way, we'd be actually a whole different game. There's an inward turn in pride. If I could just say something kind of directly to us as a group here tonight, this might put some people offside. Let's see how we go. This room feels pretty good right now. You look around, and you're like, there's a decent amount of people here. Maybe you've been part of other churches in the past, and you say, there were less people in the room than right now. And so either you're kind of working in the church or even you're just contributing to the ministry, and you're starting to think, hey, we have done a pretty good job here, building this service that we have. And you start to almost inward turn as a church. It's possible to do that. It is very possible for this church to become so excited about itself that actually we're doing the same thing that Dorothy Sayers was saying is stupid, same thing that we see Nebuchadnezzar doing, which is so stupid, which inward turning on ourself. Sometimes people who think really well about this stuff, they say, don't look at the barn, look at the field. It's a farming analogy, but you can come with me, right? Don't look at this is the barn here. You go, the barn's kind of full. You're like, great. Look at the fields that are ripe for harvest. Look at the people who are not saved, maybe just for the sake of putting something on it. Look at the area of Keringai and think about how most people have no connection to the God who made them. Feels good in here, but what about the fields? Let's not be the church that's inwardly turned. Let's be the church that cares about the lost, because I take it that was the heart of Jesus as well. So I wanted to say kind of three things about pride tonight. First one is that pride is an inward turn. The second thing I'd love to point out for you is in chapter 4, verse 33. 33 is that pride is the opposite of community. We've talked a little bit about community tonight and feeling like we belong. Notice there it says that he, Nebuchadnezzar, was driven away from people. It's not a coincidence. It was said the same way in verse 32 as well. Nebuchadnezzar's pride drives him away from people. Isn't it true to say that in 2024, we're pretty into community because we just had COVID where no one was allowed to talk to anybody else. And now we're on the back end of that and we're very excited about groups of people getting together. We're very excited about community. Now, we need to be careful in ourselves that we don't treat community like a gym where the community is always happening and it's always there and I just show up, tag in whenever I feel like it and leave and the community keeps happening. Real community is more like a sports team, right? Where you show up, there's a time that you've got to be there because everyone else is going to be there at the same time. We can't just have community on tap and jump into it when we feel like it. Notice here that pride really damages true community. You want to see a bunch of people in great community with each other? Look for a bunch of humble people. Look for a bunch of people who aren't trying to assert their greatness over each other. Look for a bunch of people who are just trying to love each other, love their neighbor as their self. You might see some really meaningful community. So first thing I want to say about pride is an inward turn. Second thing we note is it's the opposite of community. Third thing, and this is probably the most unique contribution of this passage to the idea of pride in the whole Bible, is that pride is dehumanizing. Pride is the opposite of human. Let me show it to you in the passage, verse 33 still. Notice what happens to Nebuchadnezzar is that he goes down a rung from being a human. He gets into the land of the animals. It says he was driven away from people and ate grass like the ox. His body was drenched with the dew of heaven until his hair grew like the feathers of an eagle. His nails like the claws of a bird. You get the picture here of a man who's descended to the status of an animal. We've got a picture here. You can see this in an art gallery in Boston. I really like how they've picked up the idea of those different animals and how this man is somehow meshed with the animal world. By the way, if you're into like ancient studies and mythology and stuff, the way to make a beast is to take the human and the animal and mash them together. There's nothing beastly about a bird, but there is something beastly about a man and a bird meshed together. Same thing holds through most of the Old Testament, and that's what happens to King Nebuchadnezzar. His sin dehumanizes him. Now, I've got a slightly nerdy bit. If you can stick with me for the next 30 seconds, it'll be worth your while. Here's a slide from a Bible commentator called Ernest C. Lucas. Says it really well. He says, pride is not satisfied with being a little lower than God, Psalm 8, reaches for the heavens, so blurring the human-divine distinction. When we reject our creaturely status, seek to become God, we're in danger of becoming subhuman. Can I put that in other words for you? If you read Genesis, very first book in the Bible, you get the gist that there's at least a threefold hierarchy in the world. There's God at the top. He's the creator. And then there's all of the different creation below. We're part of that, but we're not the same as it. Humans are put over the top of the other natural world. We're meant to rule and have dominion over it. Which, by the way, is why it's such a travesty when humans trash the earth. It's because we're supposed to be the ones who are having good dominion over it. And so there's just a sideswipe there in favor of kind of actually caring about the world that we live in. Now you get the idea of becoming subhuman from actually that fourth layer in the hierarchy. The slide is referencing Psalm 8, which says, God has made people a little lower than the angels. So you get this idea, okay, there's God, and then a long way below, there's angels, and just a little lower, there's people, and then below that, there's animals. But what is King Nebuchadnezzar doing? He's trying to reach up. What does God do to him? He drags him back down the hierarchy. He makes him subhuman. So we've talked so far about the nature of pride. We talked about how it's an inner turn. We talked about how pride is the opposite of community. We talked about how pride ultimately dehumanizes us. Notice as well, though, there is always the possibility of repenting from pride. If we go back to the dream itself, remember Nebuchadnezzar is pictured as like this big tree. Great pains seem to be gone to emphasize that the tree's not going to be entirely cut down. It's going to be a stump remaining. that's a nod to the idea that there is restoration possible. And King Nebuchadnezzar takes that up in verse 34. Are you sticking with me? Verse 34. At the end of that time, I, Nebuchadnezzar, raised my eyes toward heaven, and my sanity was restored. Just tune into that phrase, raised my eyes. That is the most human thing you can do. The beast raises his eyes. I don't know if you noticed this trajectory thing. If we go back to our V slide, right? He's standing on top of his palace. And where's he looking? He's looking in and he's literally looking down at the kingdom he's created. As a beast, what does he do? He looks up. And that is exactly where God takes him. That there is something about where your eyes are that's connected to your path in relationship to God. Now we come all the way to verse 37. And I'd love for you to notice two things. This is the last verse in the chapter. It says, this is his end goal. This is where he gets to. This is kind of the place that you want to be. He says, now I, Nebuchadnezzar, praise and exalt and glorify the King of Heaven, because everything he does is right and all his ways are just. When we sing in a moment, we're doing something a little bit similar to what Nebuchadnezzar is expressing here. And if you've tuned in really closely throughout the passage, you might have noticed the word acknowledge comes up over and over again. God is after people who acknowledge the way things really are. In the context of this passage, he wants people to acknowledge that God is the God and the ruler over even the most powerful political entities like Nebuchadnezzar's Babylon. God wants us to acknowledge the way things really are. So when we sing together a little bit later, that's kind of what we're doing. We are acknowledging that God is God and we are not. We are doing things like praising and exalting and glorifying him. Can I take you as well to that final sentence in this verse? Because I think it's problematic. Tell me if you can see the problem with it as well. Those who walk in pride, he's able to humble. Do you see a problem with that? If we go to Proverbs 16:18, for example, it says, pride goes before destruction. Same sentiment. Do you see a problem with that? See, Nebuchadnezzar, his pride goes before his destruction. Tick, true, no problems. But that's not always true of the world that you observe, is it? Do you observe every proud person getting humbled? Do you observe everyone who ought to be dragged down by God being dragged down? Or would it be true to observe that some people who out of their pride lead large things that hurt people, or maybe closer to home, people who just seem to be kind of coasting their way through life with no reference to the God who made them, exercising pride over and over again, seem to sometimes just go through life and die a peaceful death and that's the end of it? If I could speak to you directly for a second, if you're someone who's inclined to thinking, there's one life, you just die at the end of it, and that's kind of it. There's either worms kind of eat you in the ground or you get burned up, and that's kind of the end of the game. If you think that way, can you realize that there's actually no guarantee of justice at the end? That's an incredibly bleak way to see what's coming. This is the moment where the Christian understanding of the day of judgment that is coming when Jesus comes back to judge the living and the dead actually becomes a comfort. Because on that day, all wrongs will be righted. On that day, all the proud will be humbled. It's a guaranteed thing. But if all we've got to work with is our justice systems, we better make them a heck of a lot better, because there's no guarantee that the proud will actually be humbled in this life, apart from a couple of examples. Hey, I'm drawing kind of towards the end. I'd love to make two more points to help this land in your life tonight. First one, maybe is just a personal reflection from my life. I've had the burden this week of thinking about pride for a week. So you study, 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 think. Every now and then I'll stop and I'll go, I wonder if I'm proud. No, push that thought to the side and keep going. But deep down over the course of the week, you kind of start to recognize that I am more proud than I realized. I know that I ought not be, and yet if I'm going to be honest, and I hope that if you're honest too, you might recognize more pride in your heart than you're comfortable with. I'll give you two examples of how you might recognize pride in your own life. You recognize it when things go well and when things go bad. Nebuchadnezzar, he recognizes pride in his life when things go well. He's on top of the world. He's built like the Hanging Gardens of Babylon. He's conquered nations. That's why the book of Daniel is being written, because he conquered God's people. This guy is on top of the world, and in his prosperity, he's led into pride. In fact, verse 4, it won't come up on the screen, but chapter 4, verse 4, says that Nebuchadnezzar was at home in his palace, contented and prosperous. Have you ever felt contented and prosperous? It's a dangerous place to be for a Christian. Jesus told this parable about a guy who had a really great bumper harvest in his field. So he built a big shed and he put all the stuff in the shed. And then he sat back and he said, great, now I can chill because everything's under control. Jesus said, you fool, tonight your life's going to be demanded of you. When we're contented and prosperous, our pride can actually increase. You see that in the example of Nebuchadnezzar. On the other hand, some of us here tonight, you're actually having a really tough time in life, and I'm really sorry. And in that same moment, are you willing to come with me on the idea that our wounded pride can actually speak more loudly than anything else? That when things go badly in your life, pride also comes out of the human heart. If you've ever like lost a job, for example, or lost like a relationship, somebody that you wanted to be close to, and that thing is taken away from you, your pride screams out and says, you don't realize how valuable I am over here. You don't realize how sad you're going to be without me. And the wounded pride cries the loudest. You actually see pride in your own heart, both when things are going really well and when things go badly. Can you see it in yourself? I can see it in me. And that ought to deeply disturb us. James chapter 4. Can I get you to dwell on how direct this is? God opposes Tom, but shows grace to the humble. It is a massive thing to recognize pride in yourself. And at the same time, can I finish with this final comment? That we are, as Christians, equipped for a special kind of humility. Now, you know, like Australian humility, right? Australian humility says, yeah, it's good to be humble. Because we don't want to be like, you know, Americans or whatever it is. They tend to just like have a culture where it's normal and good to talk yourself up. In Australia, it's normal and good to make yourself as small as possible, right? Self-deprecating humor is our thing. But in both cases, all we're doing is trying to kind of fulfill the same desire to be loved, to be known, to be valued, to be respected. We're just kind of going through different cultural avenues. Can I tell you a story? I was walking through a train station in China 7-8 years ago. Now, if you've been to like Wynyard Town Hall Central anytime recently, you've been through one of those long tunnels to get from one end of the station to the other. Go there in your mind and then like quadruple the amount of people that are trying to squish through this small space. And in kind of Wynyard Town Hall Central, people at least try to dodge each other. They don't want to slam shoulders on the way through. There were way too many people in this train station to do anything like that. So everyone is just straight lining it, like shoulder bashing their way to the other end of the station. And there's like 1,000 people in this tunnel. And in that moment, I'm thinking to myself, I resent being such a small individual amongst like 1,000 people in this mob. And then I realized that in this country, there's like 1 billion people. And then I realized that like in this world, there's like 7 billion people. And I am just one of them. And something inside of me cries out against being so insignificant, just being one little number amongst all of them. And I deeply want you to know me. I want somebody to value me. I want respect. I want my name to be known. I don't just want to be an insignificant dot on a whole beach of people. And actually, that's the thing that everyone wants. But as Christians, we are specially equipped not to need to chase the prideful desire to kind of affirm ourselves and build ourselves up, because we have a God who knows how many hairs are on your head. We have a God who was with you at 2:17 p.m. We have a God who calls you his daughter, and he loves you so much. We have a God who calls you his son, and he is so proud of you, clothed in the righteousness of Jesus. We don't need to chase after prideful affirmations in the same way everyone else does. We can actually be more humble than Australian culture, because we know the God of the universe who gives us the thing that we're chasing in our pride already. Do you want to pray with me, Ben? Do you want to come up and sing? God, Father, sovereign over everyone, we ask that you'd make us humble. We repent tonight, like Nebuchadnezzar did, that we are proud, and we turn our eyes to you again. We praise you for Jesus' humility and stepping down to earth. We thank you for the salvation he offers. We ask that you'd help us to be people who, going forward, actually tap into the ability to be humble that you've given us. God, we love you, and you're so good to us, even when we're not good to you. And everyone who agreed said,